I'm looking at success as open-mindedness, frankly, on an individual level. And I mean that kind of at all levels.
So the three things that we think about is the fact that it needs to be holistic, we need to integrate across the organization and collaborate. And those three things, frankly, are the essence of doing things jointly.
Having these diverse teams really comes into play as we figure out how do we really measure adherence to these ethical principles and how do we set benchmarks.
Welcome to The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Matt Sanisbert of the Combat Capabilities Development Command's Armament Center within Army Futures Command. And I'll be joined in just a moment by Luke Shabro, Deputy Director of Mad Scientist. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the future of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. You can connect with us through Twitter, at @ArmyMadSci, or subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. On today's episode, we'll be talking with a panel of experts from the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center about the ethics of AI and machine learning, integrating these emerging technologies into the joint force, and the future of talent management in this space. We'll be speaking with Ms. Jacqueline Tame, Acting Deputy Director and Chief Performance Officer, Dr. Jane Pinellas, Chief of Test Evaluation and Assessment, and Ms. Alka Patel, Head of AI Ethics and Policy. As always, the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or Training and Doctrine Command. Let's get started. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
So let's jump right to the first question here. You all have pretty varying and diverse backgrounds, both educationally and professionally. So can each of you introduce yourselves and tell our listeners a little bit about what you do and how you got to where you are today? And Jackie, let's go with you first.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So I am the first Chief Performance Officer and currently Acting Deputy Director of the DoD Joint Artificial Intelligence Center. It's a role that I've inhabited, at least the CPO role, for about 8-ish months. Prior to this, I spent about 13 years in mostly the intelligence community and the defense intelligence space in particular. I would describe my background as a sort of blend of strategic planning, policy, performance, and kind of any of those things that you traditionally see in command elements that are like, you know, I want to do this special huge assessment, you know, find a person to sort of lead that effort. So I get a lot of those sort of special projects, which really does lend itself to kind of figuring out strategically how an organization is doing, how well aligned these sort of like resources and capabilities are to its organizational mission and functions, and then making kind of recommendations to both drive resourcing and drive, you know, increased effectiveness and impact, frankly. So most of my career, as I mentioned, was in defense intelligence, a large part at the Defense Intelligence Agency. Also spent some time at CIA and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. A little bit of time in the Navy, where I actually got to work for the CNO and study talent management for the future force, which was great and really kind of informed what I'm doing now to some extent. And then a little bit of time on the Hill, on the House Intelligence Committee, overseeing the defense intelligence portfolio, and then at the Office of the Undersecretary for Intelligence and Security right before this.
And Jane?
That's an impressive list to follow, but I'll do what I can here. So my background, my PhD is in statistics. I've spent about 12 years working in the national security space, and my work really has spanned a lot of different areas. I started out working in the Navy personnel and then workforce analysis kind of space for an FFRDC, and then moved slowly through, you know, gender integration type issues for the military, to things like nuclear nonproliferation, to war gaming, to eventually operational tests and evaluation, which is how I spent the last few years of my career. Probably some of the highlights would have been working with the Marine Corps operational test and evaluation activity on figuring out the role of women in combat arms. But most recently, I was the director of test and evaluation over at Project Maven, for USDI. And then here at the Jake, I'm the Chief of Test Evaluation and Assessment, which means that we credibly and objectively and rigorously evaluate Jake procured AI-enabled systems. And we hope to spread the lessons learned and the technology across the department. But I guess if I were to kind of summarize how I've spent my 12 plus years in the national security space, it would probably be bringing mathematical or analytical rigor to the department in various ways.
And Alka, let's go over to you.
So I have to say, first of all,
thanks again, Matt and Luke, for having us. I'm really excited to be here and, of course, follow these two accomplished women who are really pioneers in their own right. And I say that because I am new to government and I'm also new to DOD. So just listening to them every time is very inspiring. So my role at the JAIC is to lead the AI ethics policy efforts and really focused on implementing the DOD AI ethics principles that were adopted earlier this year in February. Full disclaimer, I am not an ethicist. I do not have a philosophy background, but rather I come to this with a lens of an engineer and a lawyer. So my background is, of course, engineering. I started out as an engineer for a couple of years and then proceeded to get my law degree and my MBA, and worked in private practice for a number of years as an intellectual property / patent attorney. And then worked for a global financial institution where I really got embedded in regards to thinking through risk management, compliance, audit, governance aspects of a large organization. And then most recently, was at Carnegie Mellon University, where I was leading, led a startup of a private industry and academic research innovation center. It was sponsored by PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers, the consulting company, and really focused on projects relating to AI, data analytics, cybersecurity, and privacy. And that's where I got into the space and conversation around the technology aspects as well as the ethics aspects. And so joined the JAIC earlier this year and have really been enjoying the journey as we work towards implementation of the principles.
Well, that's great. I want to thank you all for being here. We're very honored to have all three of you and to learn from each of you and your very accomplished and impressive professional backgrounds. So let's get to the questions here. In your opinion, from each of your respective areas within the JAIC, what do you see as the most important aspect of utilizing AI within the DOD? And conversely, what's the biggest roadblock that's stopping us from getting there? And Jane, we'll start with you.
Thank you. So it's one of my favorite topics to talk about. And admittedly, I do have a bias in that my area within the JAIC is test and evaluation. But I really strongly believe that one of the most important aspects of utilizing AI in the DOD is going to be AI assurance. In other words, how do we know that the systems that we're procuring do what they're supposed to be doing? How do we know that they don't do what they're not supposed to be doing? How do we make sure that they're aligned with the ethical principles that ALCA is working so hard to operationalize? How do we establish the proper requirements and benchmarks and safety cases for these systems? And how do we educate both our acquisition professionals as well as our warfighters on how risky these systems are, when they should be used, and how much they should be trusted, et cetera.
And I'll just I'll just tag on if I can for a second as well. So if I sort of take everything that Jane's saying and sort of go a little macro for a moment here, thinking through how this technology can be used to enhance sort of two aspects, the speed aspect and the human capital aspect. So with regards to speed, like using this technology to increase the OODA loop, right? So how are we equipping our joint warfighters with the best technology to protect them in their daily missions? How are we thinking about this from a human capital perspective in terms of using this technology as decision aids, right? Like, so are we increasing the efficiencies in terms of being able to help and aid individuals in whatever their functional roles may be? And then also thinking about how these technologies can also perhaps alleviate some of the burdensome, repetitive, redundant type of work so that it allows individuals to actually focus on more of the thoughtful problem-solving type issues. And I think in terms of roadblocks, I completely echo what Jane just said in terms of educating the workforce from an acquisition, a joint warfighter perspective, but really thinking through, you know, the fact that it's the entire workforce, especially when we think about ethics in terms of the fact that we believe it's everyone's responsibility. So how do we think about that workforce education piece, but also thinking through organizational structure and our operating structure? So with AI, we talk about breaking silos across an organization, right? We talk about the fact that this needs to be cross-functional. And so how do we think through how to make that happen so that we can have the right types of processes, governance structures, incentive structures to really be able to leverage this technology in the way it needs to be?
Yeah, and I think, this is a perfect segue, right? Which is another reason why I was really so excited that you guys were willing to sort of do this podcast with the three of us. We come at this from very different perspectives and very different backgrounds, but I think that sort of in and of itself is emblematic of kind of what AI does and the types of people and skill sets that AI sort of necessarily brings together, especially in sort of mission spaces like the Department of Defense. I would just pull on the thread that sort of Akko left on in two ways. One is, you know, both my colleagues have discussed kind of the what I consider a little bit of a temporal split in terms of the importance of AI and the most sort of important components of it for the department. Temporally speaking, what I would actually say is that some of the things that Akko just mentioned sort of towards the end, some of the sort of routinized back office business processes, et cetera, where we can really bring automation to bear and free up that sort of true human thought leadership and mental capacity for the more advanced things that we need to leverage it for, are really kind of available now technologically. And this is where I think we're going to see a lot of real sort of resource related return on investment today, which in turn enables us to really get continued buy-in, frankly, from our quote unquote investor communities, right? Congress, OMB, the White House, you know, department leadership, et cetera, sort of being able to prove that return on investment now in these, what I would call sort of like lower threat mission areas of the department, but nonetheless, incredibly important areas of the department in terms of sort of the defense-wide reforms that we're trying to put into place, et cetera, is really critical. Those savings, those efficiencies, those learnings that we will then generate, the way in which we then sort of translate that into what that means from a human capital perspective for the department in order to sort of continue and perpetuate these practices, then results, I think, again, in sort of that phase two temporally, in the really more kind of war fighting applications and the deployment of these technologies against the really, really hard, autonomy problems, et cetera. And the other thing that I would just say to hopefully kind of pull this a little bit together is, you know, we haven't seen really a department-wide sort of reorganization, not in terms of org chart, right, but in terms of sort of functionality and mission threads, as it were, since 1986, really not since Goldwater Nichols. I think my colleagues share in this, that this is sort of the catalyst for that redesign of the department. It has to be. And I think we're sort of seeing that play out. But the challenge, the sort of most significant, I would say, kind of roadblock right now, in my mind, is both the current kind of technological architecture in which we're working and all of the processes and policies that have sort of surrounded that architecture and make it very difficult to do all the things that I know that this podcast listeners, are already familiar with in terms of ATOs and interoperability, et cetera. But the second part of that really is this sort of cultural barriers that we have just in terms of, you know, having a lot of incredibly smart, incredibly motivated, wonderful patriots, but many of whom are in leadership positions and did not grow up as digital natives, right? I mean, even sort of in my own age group, I'm skirting that line between what I would consider a digital native and not. And I think that sort of reconciling the current group of leadership across the department, you know, well-meaning and brilliant as everybody may be, with the fact that we need people and enabling capabilities that are going to really push the boundaries on how we've operated and how we think about operating to date is kind of where we need to double down and where I think that Jake is trying to make some really big strides.
Yeah, thanks. That was great information. It sounds like we're on the precipice of significant change here. So in that same vein, then, I want to understand, how do you guys individually, as well as the Jake broadly, how do you measure success? What does it look like to you? And Jackie, we'll go back to you.
Yeah, so I'll be very honest, right? It is incredibly difficult. There's no department-wide answer yet. There's not even a Jake-wide answer yet. It's something that we're really grappling with, especially sort of the leadership team here. Obviously, in my sort of chief performance officer role, it's very important to me to help figure out. But our new director, Lieutenant General Groen, talks about a lot, and we're sort of really trying to sort of double down in this area is, what does it mean to be AI ready? To the point of your question, you know, what are those things that we would have to actually identify as indicators of that level of readiness for the department? And I would say a couple things. So individually, honestly, at this point, given where we are in the movie, I would say I'm looking at success as open-mindedness frankly, on an individual level. And I mean that kind of at all levels, from the line analyst working at an Intel shop to you know, the Secretary of Defense. You know, what is that person's understanding of the possibilities and open-mindedness to those possibilities and willingness to sort of just be very, frankly, risk tolerant in ways in which are difficult for the department, especially given our mission. And then more broadly, I think you'll see a lot of work in across the JAIC and across the department, frankly, in terms of measuring things like how ready are we from a data perspective? You know, is our data structured and curated in a way that lends itself to AI applications and AI-enabled capabilities? Are systems, our IT systems, interoperable enough to actually do something with the data that we're actually then flowing through everything? And then I would say there's a huge sort of talent workforce component, and obviously both of my colleagues' specialties in terms of test and evaluation and responsible AI and ethics, I think are worth talking about it potentially in more detail. So I want to turn it over to maybe Alka and then Jane to kind of underscore some of those things.
Yeah, thanks, Jackie. What I'll share real quick, especially from the ethics and responsible AI perspective, is the way that we look at implementation is through 4 P's. So people, processes, partnerships, and policy. And I can talk about that a little bit more later. But just to kind of pull the thread again on what Jackie was saying in terms of people and human capital, there are aspects that we can measure, right, in terms of training and education, as it might relate to how do we actually ensure that there is awareness of the DoD AI ethics principles across the organization? How do we ensure that people understand what they might mean? How do we ensure that people are utilizing processes to actually bring them to life? And so there are, you know, if we wanted to get into specific metrics, sure, there are ways we can definitely do that from a quantitative perspective. Unfortunately, a lot of this is also qualitative as well. But we just recently did do a pilot earlier this year where we took 15 cross-functional individuals across the JAIC and pulled them together to go through a 9-week experiential learning process around the principles themselves and responsible AI. And our goal is to scale that across the organization next year. And so I think when we talk about, at least from my lens and my perspective, increasing responsible AI literacy, that is something we can measure. It's definitely an important part from a workforce education perspective. The other thing that I think is also critical in terms of like an actual metric perhaps might be how many resources or how much financial resource or human capital resources are we actually putting towards these specific areas that need more attention because of the uniqueness of AI technologies, right? And so that could be another sort of factor. Thinking through again, on the acquisition side, we're also trying to navigate what kind of processes and practices we might want to adopt when it comes to perhaps language in RFIs or RFPs and contractual language as it relates to implementation. And so even thinking through that aspect, there's ways we can measure it. And then the last one I'll just quickly mention before I pass it over to Jane is the policy side. So what kind of policies do we have? Do we need to have? Do we need to revisit? Because they might actually be barriers in existing policies for us to actually think about how we are adopting and scaling AI across the organization. And so while policy isn't the end all in terms of measurement, it is one factor that is definitely worth considering in terms of how we scale more broadly. So I did want to at least talk about the policy piece just, and then on that point, the one last thing I'll just mention too is when it comes to policy too, right, recognizing how this technology is evolving and changing constantly, like there's something new happening, especially in the ethics space on a daily basis. And we don't have all the answers yet, right? And so we are learning as we're doing and recognizing that as we think about policy, how do we ensure that the policies that we may create around this gives us the flexibility that we need to be able to take into account sort of all these uncertainties that still lay ahead of us. Jane, I'll turn it over to you.
So I'll add to this, you know, I think both Jack and Alka have addressed a lot of the kind of broad measures of success. I'll address just some of my individual measures of success. And by individual, I just mean especially important to test and evaluation. And I've been doing test and evaluation in the department probably for about 10 years. And I started by supporting the services, specifically the Navy and the Marine Corps, and then eventually moved to support the Department of Operational Test and Evaluation at the OSD level. And what you see undoubtedly when, you know, when you start looking at the history of test and evaluation is that there have been great minds and great policy makers implementing policies and requirements for really, really sound scientific practices for test and evaluation that then the services really have a lot of trouble keeping up with. Not because they don't want to, but because they encounter all of these challenges that both Alka and Jackie have already mentioned. Challenges with workforce, challenges with technology, challenges with, you know, even knowledge sometimes and scientific rigor and resources. You know, I think one of my most important metrics of success at the JAIC when it comes to T&E is how am I enabling the services to eventually test these systems when they come online? Because I know that the challenges that the services are going to encounter. I've been there firsthand. I've been deployed to two of those commands and I've seen the challenges that they have. And so how am I removing those barriers as programs of record become devoted to an AI-enabled systems? Specifically, you know, at the JAIC, we procure some technology. How can I make sure that that technology is accessible and usable by service operational test commands? How can I package the knowledge that I'm getting from testing a specific JAIC product that I can then disseminate it to the rest of the department T&E community? And I lead a department-wide subcommittee on test and evaluation of AI. In that subcommittee, with the help of my partners in R&E, DOT&E developmental test, OSD policy, as well as the services and the rest of the JAIC, we've basically been able to enumerate the gaps in test and evaluation of AI. So now I have a list of gaps that I think the JAIC will largely be best positioned to fill over time, or at least to make actionable recommendations on how they should be filled over time. So I think those are going to be some of my measures of success is how does my team enable the services and the department to collectively test AI-enabled systems when they come online.
In a similar vein, I just wanted to ask, I think it's really interesting. So we're talking to you from the JAIC, and previously we've done work with the Army AI Task Force. We had Michael Keenan on, who's the co-chair for Air Force AI. And, you know, as we see these ventures across all the different services, what is the importance of jointness?
Yeah, so it's funny because several of us were having a discussion just this morning about this very thing. I would say two things to start this sort of thread. One is it's critical. Like I said earlier, and like my colleagues, I think, have underscored, AI represents an opportunity that I personally believe will catalyze, you know, the sort of way in which the department operates in a very new direction, almost redefining what it is to be joint, enabling the idea and the concept of jointness in a way that I don't think we've actually been able to actualize since 1986. I think what we've had is sort of doctrinal definitions of jointness and sort of, you know, really a lot of effort to operate in a joint manner. But what we haven't had is sort of the technological underpinnings enabling us to do that at speed, at scale, sort of, you know, very consistently and repeatedly across the force. The interesting part, right, of both this question and the intent behind the question is actually something that I, you know, I'll comment on, but it's a little bit controversial, which is that we are the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center. Doctrinally, as I mentioned, joint means something very specific in terms of your operating construct, in terms of command and control, in terms of your span of control, in terms of your mission set. And yet we actually are not technically, organizationally, part of the joint force. We fall under the Chief Information Officer within OSD. And that, frankly, presents a challenge. Not the fact that we fall under the CIO. That's not the challenge. The challenge, though, is how does an organization like the JAIC operate in support of and across the joint force if it is not in and of itself a part of the joint force, right? And so I think that this, the very fact that we have fallen sort of organizationally for very good reasons in a lot of cases in a part of the department that does not innately kind of see itself as, or and certainly is not in actuality a part of that kind of doctrinal joint force, presents some very interesting challenges, specifically in the areas of things like military fills. For a discipline that is changing as rapidly as AI is, we need, I believe, and I think our director would say, the absolute best across the entirety of the force to come to the Jake, do a tour here, especially our military fills, and then go back into the joint force and, you know, train the trainer, sort of teach others, you know, institutionalize the practices and the learnings that they've been able to get by being part of the Jake. And right now, again, you know, not falling under that sort of joint construct and instead falling under CIO, you know, unfortunately, that just kind of puts us at a little bit of a disadvantage in terms of the actual kind of prioritization of fill. So I offer all that, not because it necessarily answers the sort of literal part of the question, but because symbolically, I think it's actually really important to talk about jointness, what it means doctrinally, and what you can and can't do under the current sort of very archaic operating model of the Department of Defense that we are desperately trying to change.
So I'll jump in here just for a little bit, again, with my slightly narrower perspective, I think. But I think on all levels that we mentioned before, on the resource level, on a technological level, on a workforce level, we cannot afford to do this separately. We cannot afford to do this in any other way than a joint organization. We need that variety of perspectives, but also it's not just about the diversity of thought. It's about, no kidding, the amount of time and money that it takes to become AI ready, to get the right data, to label the right data, to figure out how to do acquisitions for AI-enabled systems, how to test AI-enabled systems, how to operate them. You know, we currently, I think we are operating a little bit in silos. There are definitely places that are coming up with their own boutique solutions and for good reasons, right? In some cases, they simply cannot afford to wait for the rest of us to figure it out. And in some cases, there is a real tension there between our desire to be joint and our desire to share data and models, et cetera, and just very, very specific needs of particular services and specific programs. Frankly, for some of them, their needs change more than once within one day, right, depending on the operation that's being conducted. So there's a real tension there between both our desire and realization for the necessity of this jointness, but also interoperability is really hard to achieve, and in some cases expensive, and in some cases too constraining.
Sure. No, I think you and Jackie both have done a wonderful job of laying out the criticality and the importance of the joint aspect. If there's anything more I could add, it's probably a bit repetitive, but I'll just share, you know, again, when we think about, and I'm coming from my ethics lens again, when we think about implementation of the responsible AI aspect across the organization, sort of the three things that we think about is the fact that it needs to be holistic, we need to integrate across the organization and collaborate. And those three things, frankly, are the essence of doing things jointly, right? Like breaking down the silos that Jane just mentioned. And how, if we're going to transform and do this right, then, and that's, we have to do it collectively. I know, for example, Mike Kanan, who you mentioned, Luke, is doing wonderful things at the Air Force. And I know sort of my counterparts over at Army AI Task Force with Colonel Barnes and is also doing great things. And we're all sort of going in the same direction, but how do we ensure that we are doing this in a centralized fashion, or that we are at least aligned centrally at a higher level so that we are all going in the same direction to really effectuate the change that we need to? And so the joint aspect for this technology, again, and the need to do it collectively is even more so critical. And I think this has already been shared previously too, is the fact that not only are we talking about breaking down sort of organizational silos, but if we think about it from a disciplines perspective, backgrounds perspective, we need a variety of disciplines and backgrounds at the same table. So just because we're talking about AI technology doesn't mean that this conversation is limited to just the technologists, right? We need the ethicists, we need the social scientists, we need all of these other disciplines at the table to bring their viewpoints, their lens, their expertise as we try to figure this out collectively.
I think that's actually a phenomenal segue to our next question, which really is, what are the personnel changes that each of you are facing? What are we going to have to do as we're trying to get all this talent and skills, and we have this this really tall task ahead of us. What are we going to have to do to modify or change recruiting, the way we educate, the way we train our personnel?
On the test and evaluation side, this problem is really not new to us. I can tell you that most of the testers in the department I know by name, and I've sat in the same room with them at some point, which on the one hand is really good for kind of interoperability and working together concerns, frankly, that we just talked about in the previous question. But on the other hand, is extremely problematic, right? Because as we recruit, for instance, you know, does that mean I'm robbing Peter to pay Paul, right? Am I just taking a super talented person from another organization within the DoD that desperately needs that person? So some of it is as, you know, simple as just having enough STEM candidates, frankly, that we can even recruit from. And that's always been an issue in the technological aspects of how the department hires. But also, as Alka was mentioning, I think we really need to broaden our aperture as far as what kind of people we're now interested in hiring, right? Because there's a huge diversity of skill sets that's now required that's well beyond STEM. One of the sciences, for instance, that we're starting to gravitate towards is psychology and cognitive behavioral sciences, right? So as you think of learning systems and how we should evaluate learning systems, as well as how we should evaluate human factors and human machine teaming and human system integration in general, all of those disciplines come into play. Frankly, they've been doing this for quite some time, and we have just a tremendous amount to learn from that. Another discipline we might consider is something like education, right? People who know how to evaluate children's learning, we probably have something to learn from them when it comes to evaluating AI-enabled systems that incorporate learning. Humans are our biggest autonomous systems that the DoD currently deploys. And so there's much to be learned from how we evaluate them currently. Plus, you know, when we start getting into things now like ethical considerations, that opens up a whole another possibility of people with a diverse set of backgrounds. But I think in general, we need to just orient ourselves towards people who are analytical thinkers in all disciplines and start broadening our aperture as far as what kind of backgrounds we're willing to consider for some of these jobs. Now, the personnel challenge is still there. And I think to me, probably the biggest issue in the department that needs to change is culture. I think that's more important than compensation, although that really helps, at least initially, to attract someone, maybe not to retain. The department cannot be viewed as the slow bureaucratic organization. The stuff that we're working on is incredibly interesting. We go home every day feeling patriotic and good about the impact that we make. And we need to get that message across. Some of that already exists. And some of it, we do need to become more agile as a department. In test and evaluation specifically, we need to start being viewed as an active contributor to development of these systems rather than, you know, a hoop somebody has to jump through before the system deploys. So we definitely have the potential to attract, I think, this wider talent, but I think both our culture and our messaging need to change.
And I wholeheartedly agree with that, everything that Jane has said. I will say, never having worked for the government and joining the DoD, I learned that there is no greater mission than what I do every day, trying to support the organization and our men and women who are out in the field. So it's definitely an incentive and a driver to bring folks to the organization. Now, of course, all the bureaucratic or organizational structure barriers are there and need to sort of be reconsidered. From the culture aspect, with respect to responsible AI, I will say one of our biggest challenges is trying to create this new mindset, right? And similar to what Jane was saying on the T&E aspect, ethics isn't a product or it's not something that gets tacked on at the very end, right? And it's not just a technologist problem, but it's one that is something that has to be addressed early on, something that's integrated and embedded throughout. And it should be seen as an enabler and not an inhibitor. And so I think thinking through how do we increase our responsible AI literacy again to sort of overcome that personnel challenge of understanding what we're trying to do with the ethics principles and responsible AI. In terms of skill sets, I will say because this impacts, again, like I said, it's not just the technologists issue to address, but rather everyone. There are aspects of ethics that play into the workforce element, the acquisition element, the aspect of perhaps international dialogues. And so thinking through what kind of skills we need to be able to work across all those different areas with that responsible AI lens is really critical. And it's not like anyone comes out of school saying, all right, well, at least not right now. I don't believe, like in undergrad, like we're coming out as AI ethicist experts, not yet. I know the education system in academia is moving towards changing the curriculums and trying to increase talent pools in that area. But I think while that happens, we also have a responsibility within the organization in tandem to do as much as we can to increase the learning within our own workforce. But I think those skills and the skills in terms of being very cross-disciplinary, almost being sort of translator and intermediaries, I often see myself in that role in terms of translating perhaps between the technical and the business aspects or the policy aspects. I think those are unique type of skills. And I think those are ones that can be gained by just sort of, again, reinforcing the need for cross-disciplinary engagement and trying to really think through how can we bring those disciplines together? How can we encourage cross-collaboration and problem-solving type skills for what we're going to need as we go forward? And Jackie, I don't know if you want to, I'm sure you want to add to that as well.
Look, I mean, I think you guys covered it almost perfectly. I just, the only thing that I would add, you know, is something that, picking up on something that Jane said earlier, which is, you know, we focus a lot, especially in terms of talent management, on the recruit side of the house. And I think we spend a lot of time and money and energy thinking about and identifying sort of the best people that we need in a moment's notice. And that is right. But I think where we usually lose and end up sort of wasting resources, frankly, is not really projecting out the retain part and the professional development and training that you have to, especially in this field, allow for and ensure both the resources are available for and the flexibility in terms of schedule is available for in order to retain that top talent in any part of, you know, in any discipline that's sort of contributing to this field, especially on the technical side of the house. And I think, you know, one of the things that we're seeing and learning, hopefully this is a lesson that we are exporting to the department sort of effectively so that they don't have to learn it, you know, at the same scale that sort of we have in the Jake is, you know, if you as an organization have not really thought through your own kind of internal policies for and allowances for keeping your own workforce up to date on the most cutting edge sort of resources and capabilities and learnings that there are in their respective fields, you know, the best people are going to want to go somewhere else because they're going to want that. They're going to crave that level of expertise and that sort of, you know, being at the top of their respective fields. And obviously that's what we want and need for the department. And so even things as simple as what percentage of your workforce's time are you allowing for them, you know, akin to the sort of Google model of 20%, you know, go do something else, whether it's, you know, professional development or working on another project that's sort of in a related field that's going to advance the mission of the organization. Thinking about those things ahead of time and sort of institutionalizing practices and training, frankly, supervisors to allow for those things, I think is something that we department wide are kind of suffering for not having done effectively to date.
So in that discussion that we just had, there was actually discussion already of ethics. And so that really brings about, how do we really ensure that ethics are really being taken into account and built into these systems as we're working towards these problems? What do we do in order to build that and integrate that as we go along? And then what happens when we actually encounter that ethical problem in an AI system that's already deployed? What do we do then?
Yeah, great question, Luke. So we did touch briefly in regards to some of our efforts on the ethics side. I will just sort of echo a couple or reiterate. Hopefully, it's not too redundant. But the way that we are implementing at the Jake and viewing this echoes, I think, some of the comments that have already been made. If I go sort of macro for a second, we are really trying to ensure centralized alignment in terms of how we want to implement, recognizing that the execution needs to be decentralized, right? So the services have their own sort of respective structures, processes, resources. And so how can we at the Jake provide an implementation guide or strategy that could be used as a resource for all the different components to be able to then go put into practice within their areas? And when we think about that implementation, doing it through the four P's of people, processes, partnerships, and policy. And so I think we've covered well enough on the people aspect and the human capital and the workforce education aspect. But if I take a moment to think through the processes aspect, really thinking through like tools and frameworks that we need to build and utilize that so that we can integrate it and embed them into existing workflows, right? The key here is to really decrease the barrier to adoption of these tools and frameworks that we need to put into place. And so these tools and frameworks might be, for example, data cards and model cards, something that we've been testing out at the Jake. They could be a harms analysis at the very beginning. And if I circle back on something that I said earlier, the point being is that we need to start early. And we need to have continuous vigilance and diligence and intentionality across the entire AI product lifecycle from design, development, deployment, and use. And so thinking through what are the necessary tools that we need in place? Where is the necessary documentation we need in place? How are we ensuring that there's traceability of decisions that have been made along that product lifecycle and that information is transparent and usable by whoever is touching that technology during that lifecycle so that they have line of sight into what has been done before or why a decision has been made so that they can be more effective in their role as this technology is being developed. So I think that's a really important piece. And then if we move away from the technology aspect, thinking about like governance structures, what kind of governance structures do we need? And so we do have, similar to Jane's T&E subcommittee, we have a responsible AI subcommittee that has representation from across the DoD. And we've really been thinking through like, what does the governance structure need to look like? How do we, again, break down some of those silos, bring the right people to the table together with the right subject matter expertise to be thinking about these issues critically and thinking about either new ways or new tools that we might utilize. And the other piece is like even integrating, when I was talking about integration, integrating into platforms. So the Joint Common Foundation, for example, is that thinking through how we can embed and integrate some of our practices that we're considering into the infrastructure right from the very beginning. So we are in the process of trying to put all of those pieces together. Again, we are creating the strategy and implementation document that can be a resource for the various areas. I think, too, I'll just kind of mention really briefly, in addition to sort of these tools and frameworks I've been talking about, I think two other sort of really important concepts is one, thinking through incentive structures, right? So thinking about the existing processes and practices that are already in place at the organization, do we need to think about new incentive structures to actually move the needle and expedite the implementation as it comes to responsible AI? And then how do we think about monitoring and thinking about iterative feedback loops once this technology is actually deployed and in use? And I think that goes to sort of your second question in terms of what happens when there's a problem and an AI system has already been deployed. And I think part of that solution, and I'll definitely defer to Jane for her comments as well, because I know she's got thoughts on this. But I think from my perspective, it is absolutely critical that once a technology has been deployed, it's not like we're done with our ethics review or our need to be responsible around these technologies. In fact, it's probably even more critical for us to be more diligent and mindful of that transition from a controlled environment to sort of being put out in the wild and now ensuring that the performance and the expectations and the use, frankly, of that technology is still in line with what was originally intended. And if it changes or varies, or the technology, there's some emergent behavior, how are we pulling back? And one, being notified of that. And two, what is our contingency plan? Do we have it the ability to disengage that technology, for example? And so being mindful about what that process looks like at that part of the life cycle. But Jane, I know we've talked about this before, and I know you have thoughts and would love for you to share those as well.
So the way the test and evaluation views these ethical principles and our role specifically in implementing them is we basically started looking at ethics as our customer, right? So usually, traditionally in test and evaluation, the customer's missions or operations, and you figure out what are the operational requirements, how do you translate them into something quantitative that you can somewhat easily measure, and then you just keep measuring the performance according to those. So now we have added to that ethical requirements, right? So the five principles, we have to talk to the ethics team to try to figure out how do we translate them into something we can continuously test throughout system development. That's a new challenge for us, one that we've embraced enthusiastically, but challenging nevertheless. As you can imagine, most of us on the T&E team come from a very technical background. And so this is where having these diverse teams really comes into play as we figure out how do we really measure adherence to these ethical principles and how do we set benchmarks for, you know, when do you know you've done okay? When do you know you've done something that's completely unacceptable? So, and some of these principles and measuring adherence to them can be somewhat easily automated and built in our automatic test harnesses in kind of a quick and repeatable way. And then some of it is much more complex, qualitative at times, and bespoke kind of to the system for which it's created. Now, you know, on your question that has to do with potentially, you know, deploying a system and then it not adhering to some principles, there are a few issues there. You know, so runtime monitoring is kind of a newer problem for the test evaluation community. Traditionally, right, if I'm testing a tank or a helmet, I test it extensively, and then it gets deployed, and I usually don't worry about it again, unless there, you know, something comes back from the field that's really terrible, that's more than an anecdote, and we start building data to analyze. So for us, runtime monitoring, the idea that we deploy a system and we're able to keep our eyes on it and figure out when something goes awry or when it needs retraining, perhaps, when it's drifted, that is a new and interesting problem, both technologically and also just from a ConOps perspective. You know, sure, we can talk about essentially building in an off switch, right? So that if something goes awry, we can turn it off. That's actually an additional testing problem because then testers need to ensure the off switch works. I would also argue that emergent behavior is not necessarily limited to machines, right? Emergent behavior can occur with humans as well, especially as you introduce machines that change their entire workflow. So we have to monitor that as well. But I'll finish this by a more hopeful thought, which is that many of these things have been happening this whole time and have existed for a really long time in the DoD. The laws of war have existed for a long time in the DoD. We know what our left and right bounds are for behavior. Our biggest autonomous agents, which are humans, right? We rely on them to go and do their work, and some of them behave ethically, and sometimes some of them fall through the cracks. One of the biggest things we worry about on the ethics side, for instance, tends to be data privacy. I can tell you, as somebody who spent about 7 years working in the area of Navy personnel, there have been a tremendous amount of work done to ensure that we're extremely careful about data privacy. This is by no means a new problem. And so many of the techniques to ensure that we're in compliance with all the legal requirements and ethical requirements, many of those checks are already in place. So I think it's important, you know, even though some of these ethical issues are new to us as we engage with these AI-enabled systems, many of them the department has been thinking for a long time, and many of them have solutions already.
Yeah, and if I could just sort of double down on what Jane said, I think she makes a great point, right? Like the principles themselves are founded on existing DoD ethical and legal frameworks that are already in place. So to our point, it's not like we're starting from scratch, frankly, right? So we do have existing processes in place, whether it comes to like weapon reviews processes, law of war, and so forth. The other piece I just want to, you know, as Jane was talking, I just want to sort of connect the dots a little bit too to our earlier conversation in terms of the fact that the joint aspect and the cross-functional aspect. So what we're trying to do on the ethics side touches what, you know, the CDO, for example, with their data strategy, talking about data ethics, right? Like there has to be alignment there. We're also in connection, in conjunction with our CMO's office that leads a lot of the privacy efforts and doing the privacy impact assessments. And so again, because the ethics piece isn't just limited to one aspect of the technology, we do need to make sure that we are connecting the dots across the organization for all these different parts, because all of these different parts are impacted. And so making sure that we are tapped in. So I just wanted to circle back on that because it reinforced the whole fact of this joint concept and the need to really be cross-collaborative.
Yeah, that's great. It sounds like the foundation for a lot of this stuff is already here, and we're just looking to adapt it or translate it to these specific problem sets. So let's transition now to what we call our rapid-fire questions. These are the questions we ask all of our guests. So let's start with the first one. What technology or trend keeps you up at night? And Jackie, let's start with you, then Jane, and then Alka, you can finish it off.
Really briefly, the technology that keeps me up at night is not exactly what you would think. And it is kind of distributed ledger technology, or what people often refer to as blockchain. And the only reason it keeps me up at night is because I'm so frustrated that we haven't sort of incorporated it further into the way in which we're thinking about our government, our federal government business, because I think it offers a lot of really, really sort of necessary capability that solve a lot of our problems today.
All right, I'll follow up and I'll say some of the things that keep me up at night. Would be probably in the adversarial AI space. You know, I'm not so much worried about, you know, changing pandas to toasters or anything like that. But what I do worry about is that the research community has dedicated a lot of resources towards these super interesting but kind of niche problems, when I think there are much more risky things that we have to worry about. There are a lot easier ways to fool these systems, even, you know, than patches and data poisoning. And so that's what keeps me up at night, is whether or not we'll be able to devote resources and in time towards figuring out how to, I guess, strengthen the resiliency of our AI-enabled systems against adversary actions.
And then I'll just add two quick ones. One, which I've already sort of alluded to, is, first of all, we don't know what we don't know, right? So especially when we think about transitioning these technologies from the production environment to actually out in the field, how do we monitor these technologies for the very reasons that we've already talked about? And so that is definitely something that I think about all the time. And the second piece is really thinking through the fact that, you know, AI is just a tool, right? It's a tool. But how do we ensure that this tool is used by moral agents, right? Like, so how do we make sure that the people and the entities using these technologies are using them in the way that they should be utilized?
Jane, did I hear you say turning a panda into a toaster? Because that's going to keep me up at night now. That's my answer to that question. So the second one, what's something about you that most people might not know?
Coming to me, I am a trained opera singer.
That's awesome.
I actually knew that about you because I looked at your resume at some point.
That's amazing, Matt. We've had professional swimmer, ballroom dancer, professionally trained opera singer. We actually have quite a variety on here now.
And Dr. G is a piano player. We could put a whole show on at this point.
All right, I'll go next. So most people, when they talk to me, and especially in a professional setting, assume that I'm a technical expert, which I hope I am. But one of the things that you don't know about me is that I changed my major 8 times in college. And in fact, one of my majors was art history.
What?
Wow.
Excellent.
Still graduated in 4 years, but with 3 majors because I took so many classes.
Okay, Alka, you're up.
Yeah, so mine's not as exciting as you two guys. Like, wow. All right, so mine is that my first job out of undergrad was at a steel mill. I was in the remelt department, actually working on the floor as a process engineer.
Well, I don't think we've had a more diverse group of answers on this podcast before. That's awesome. All right, last question here. And usually people say this is the hardest one. What is your favorite movie?
All right, for me, it's a tie. The Devil Wears Prada and Inception.
Okay, I'll break that tie. It's Inception.
So, you know, as I thought about my favorite movies, some classics that came to mind, like the Godfather series. I also really like movies that have good music, such as Walk the Line, for instance. But anybody who actually knows me would probably call me if I didn't truly mention my most favorite movie of all, which is Dumb and Dumber.
Classic.
I love it. Says our PhD statistician. That's my favorite.
That's the joy of that movie. It just speaks to everyone.
All right. So I think we still have a tie because I was going between two movies myself. Jackie, my first movie was Devil Wears Prada as well. And that was because it was reminding me somewhat of my private practice days. So that was one of them. But actually, most recently, and this goes to show you like how far behind I am with my movies, but I just watched Argo, and I think, it really touched me because I love the aspects of like these creative solutions, right? Like thinking outside the box and sort of the conviction people have to find problems or find solutions for these really intractable problems. And so I think those are really inspiring to me.
Yeah, that's great. Cause I always love to end on a great analogy like that, where we can take an answer from, you know, something as unconnected as what's your favorite movie to, hey, these are real thought processes we can have to solve problems we face here in the military. So that's wonderful. So I want to thank you guys. This has been a great discussion. We're honored to have you guys on. If there's anything else you guys want to say to our audience, or is there anywhere they can follow you or follow your work?
Yeah, I think we're all three on LinkedIn under our respective names. You can certainly follow the Jake's work at AI.mil, M-I-L. And I encourage you to do so. And we also have a pretty significant presence on LinkedIn and Twitter as well. I will say one more thing, and I understand the interest of time, but to go back to the movies and The Devil Wears Prada, not because of The Devil Wears Prada, but I think this is important. One of the reasons The Devil Wears Prada really spoke to me as a movie is because it's really difficult for women in high-powered industries and sort of fast-paced industries to not eat one another alive as they're sort of crawling their way to the top. This is just sort of my experience historically. And this is a case, the AI space, this the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center, the fact that I get to work with these two unbelievably brilliant, talented experts in their respective fields, and the fact that the three of us happen to be women is something that I just absolutely adore. You don't have to be a technical expert, as Alka has said, to work in this field. We need all types. I'm certainly not, as an opera singer and a French major. And I think that I just want to sort of underscore the fact that, you know, This is a big equalizer in terms of the diversity of expertise that we actually need and backgrounds in this field. And I encourage everyone, no matter what your background and expertise is, to really consider being a part of this field, because we need you regardless of what you've done.
All right. I'd be a monster if I didn't concede that point. I reinstate the tie.
Thank you so much.
Well said, Jackie.
Okay, guys, I want to thank you one last time. Thanks for being on the show. Thanks for talking AI with us, and thanks for giving us your opinions.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guests, Ms. Jacqueline Tain, Dr. Jane Pinellas, and Ms. Alka Patel of the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center. You can connect with Mad Scientist through Twitter, at @ArmyMadSci, and don't forget to subscribe to our blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madscblog.tradoc.army.mil.